Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me this week on the roundtable, we have Joe Ingles, senior reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
And Laura Bischoff, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Laura.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Noah Blundo, executive editor with Hanna News Service. Welcome back, Noah.
Good morning.
Hello. So football fans in Ohio can breathe a sigh of relief. The four-year losing streak to Michigan ended on Saturday. Ohio State's 27-9 win over its arch rival means Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel will not have to wear a University of Michigan sweater vest and post a picture on social media. Instead, the Lieutenant Governor of Michigan will have to sport an Ohio State sweater vest. Joe, you know, Tressel coached the Buckeyes. He had 9 wins and only 1 loss against Michigan. So I can imagine he would not have enjoyed wearing that vest if they had won. Do you have any reaction to the big game?
I watched it kind of. I was doing several things at the same time, so I wasn't fully invested in every bit of it, and I didn't really realize until after the fact what Tressel and the governor had bet. But it was nice that the Buckeyes won.
Yeah, the governor DeWine and the Michigan governor Gretchen Whitmer, they wagered potato chips. So so they're sending potato chips back and forth. Laura, any reaction from you to the big game?
Well, first off, I think that governors DeWine and Whitmer's test or bet was kind of on the boring side, and I think the lieutenant governor bet was a little juicier. I'm going to be the victim of the same bet because I bet Jesse Ballmert, my colleague at the our Ohio Bureau, the same deal. The loser wears the winner's gear in public, and this will be my first time ever wearing any Buckeye gear in my entire life. I'm a proud Michigan graduate.
Oh, man.
And
do you own any? Where are you going to get it?
I don't. Yeah. I'm sure that there will be donations made to the cause. Jesse, I think, has probably picked out my outfit already. So anyway, it was a bad loss for Michigan, good win for Ohio State, and there you have it.
Well, it was a big difference. You know, what a difference a year makes for head coach Ryan Day, who faced enormous criticism and calls for his resignation last year. His family even received death threats, and he had to have personal security after losing last year. So at the post-game press conference on Saturday, he talked about what the game meant.
To tell you that the last 4 years have been easy is not true. I take the responsibility of being the head coach at Ohio State very, very seriously. So does my family, so do the players, so do the coaches. So, you don't accomplish those things, you take it personally. And I understand what that means. I mean, my family's been here 9 years now, so there's nobody who wants to win this game more than me. But to win this game, it's just a great moment. And I'm just, it's one of those moments that you want to just grab on for a while and just enjoy it, because, you know, just to see the joy on everybody's face is really what this thing's all about.
Oh, so Laura, even as a Michigan fan, can you feel a little happy for Ryan Day?
Sure. And also, I think like this whole idea of death threats and calling for resignations because he lost one game in a season is just outrageous. Everybody should just calm down.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's really kind of, for me as a football fan, it really has taken a lot of joy out of football with all of the negativity that goes on and with this fandom around this sport. It's just negative, the belittling, the hatefulness. I'm sick of it.
I'd also add that the Michigan player who headbutted the official in the first quarter should have been removed from the game right away. That's outrageous.
Agreed. Noah, you have anything to weigh in? You're being quiet over there.
No, I was having friends over on Saturday, so I was just getting ready and didn't watch.
All right. Well, the next thing up is the Big Ten Championship playing Indiana on Saturday. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. With us today, we have Noah Blundo with Hanna News Service, Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We do have a few more sports-related stories to talk about in a minute, but first, I want to cover some news that happened around the Thanksgiving holiday. Two members of the West Virginia National Guard were shot last week. Specialist Sarah Beckstrom, age 20, died from her injuries. Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf, 24, remains hospitalized in critical condition. They were serving as a part of the 2,000 troops who are on the ground in the nation's capital. Ohio troops remain in D.C. Governor DeWine earlier extended their mission until February 28th. They were originally supposed to leave at the end of November. Joe, do you know if Governor DeWine has made any public comments related to National Guard members being shot in D.C.?
I haven't seen any yet. And of course, we haven't had an opportunity to ask him with the holidays, but he is holding a press event this morning over in Dayton, probably right now, actually. And I suspect that that will be one of the first questions that reporters ask him, just to get his response to it and see what he says.
Yeah. Noah, do you think that... you know, he extended their mission, was supposed to end at the end of November, but now President Trump is calling for even more troops to come. Do you think Ohio will have more of a role now?
I'm not sure. I know that, you know, it's not the same, excuse me, it's not the same personnel staying the entire time. He's talked about he's rotating people back as they need to or want to come. And he said we've been selective in who we send in terms of not having anyone who currently serves in a law enforcement role here in Ohio being part of that mission. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that our Ohio's contribution will necessarily expand.
Mm. Laura, there's been a lot of back and forth with DeWine and sending National Guard troops to D.C. You know, at the beginning, he was criticized, and I don't know if that criticism has died down. What do you make of Ohio continuing with the National Guard troops there?
I think this is just part of what a lot of states are doing, and particularly with Republican governors. They want to support Donald Trump's efforts to, you know, quell whatever crime waves he sees in these urban cities. I do think that in Ohio, you know, after that big fight down in Cincinnati that kind of went viral and caught a lot of national attention, I think there was sort of a risk that maybe the Trump administration would want to do the same thing in Cincinnati or in Ohio cities. And it seems to me like the DeWine administration has tried to blunt that by having these violent crime reduction initiatives in the different cities. And actually, the thing that he's doing in Dayton today is along those lines. And so, you know, I think that DeWine's been very careful to kind of walk a line of supporting the president, but also trying to keep control over what's happening in Ohio as well.
All right. We'll have to wait and see what kind of reaction he has after his press event today. This is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Moving back to sports for a few minutes, Governor DeWine in a recent interview said that he regrets signing the sports betting in general into law. And he's continuing with his work of trying to limit prop betting. So, Joe, in this case, I mean, is he trying to put the genie back in the bottle here? I mean, he says he regrets signing sports betting into law. What do you make of that?
Well, I think he has always been hesitant with betting when where betting has been concerned. I mean, here's the deal, Amy. If you look at the situation, whether it's betting, whether it's NIL, all of these different changes that have come about in sports, they're not coming because lawmakers want them so much or that the governors want them. It's that ordinary people, the fans, want the betting, and the players want the NIL kind of things. And there are a lot of ramifications when you expand gambling, as Ohio has. I think the governor has seen that, and he is reacting to that.
Yeah, and Noah, you know, DeWine has made comments about the deep pockets of these betting companies, but they also invest in politicians, contributing to even DeWine's reelection campaign. So what about the idea of the money to be made? Like, isn't that why the governor went for this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. He's tried to, obviously, you know, people contribute to try to get whatever influence they can, but he has he has once succeeded and once failed in trying to raise the tax on sports gambling, for example. So, you know, he has tried to push back where he has the ability.
And Laura, he wants to kind of pull back a little bit on prop bets. These are like the tiny bets. Is that just his way? The only thing he can do right now? When I said putting the genie back in the bottle, he can limit a few things.
Yeah, he might be able to put a little tiny bit of the genie back in the bottle. But, you know, I would say that, you know, betting and drinking and marijuana and some of these, you know, sin industry areas, it's just not part of the DeWine brand. He's always been very cautious about these things, and it's not that that Mike DeWine isn't a sports fan. The guy goes to just about every possible sporting event, and his family owns a minor league baseball team, the Asheville Tourists. So he understands the industry, and I think he's trying to do it his way.
All right, and then one other sports-related topic that I did want to talk about before we move on is high school athletes can now make name, image, and likeness deals after a vote from the schools that make up the Ohio High School Athletic Association. So, Joe, this was 79% of the 568 schools voted to approve the changes. So not everyone was in favor, but a big majority here. Can you tell me more about this idea? Why do we want to have high school athletes making some money here?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that all of those schools who voted for that actually wanted it. But I think the thing was that they were pressed with a lawsuit that from a Dayton area football player, high school football player who has committed to Ohio State. Mm-hmm. That lawsuit loomed. There were also indications that federally that there would be something happening that would, dictate how they have to handle NIL. And with all those things being in the background, I do think that that played into the way that the high schools voted on that. Because they had voted before, kind of taken a, I don't know if they actually took an official vote, but the high schools had been kind of dragging their feet on this whole NIL thing. There's a lot that goes into NIL when you think about it especially from a high school perspective. When you've got individual players who are celebrated, and this can happen in college, but more so in high school, individual players who are all of a sudden sucking the oxygen and maybe the dollars out of the room. The schools are all of a sudden, you know, not having that team atmosphere maybe that they had before. So there's a lot of things that go into it. And you've got children who, and they are children, yeah, if you're, you know,
very
in
much
high
so.
School. You've got children who are underage who are, you know, faced with possibly coming into a lot of money in an NIL deal. And they're not used to handling the tax ramifications of, you know, you get a bunch of money handed to you, you've got to pay taxes on that. You've got to decide.
Or at least
what to
your
do.
Parents do.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So there's a whole lot that goes into it. And I think that there's been some feet dragging along the way, but the headwinds were what had presented. And then at that point, the schools were like, okay, well, we've got to do this.
The Ohio High School Athletic Association media relations director, his name is Tim Streed. He said the organization pushed for this yes vote on the NIL bylaw change, which it doesn't often do, because it felt that some structure would be better than no guidelines at all. Here is what he said about students being paid.
A drummer in the school's band can get paid because he's a good drummer. A student can get paid for a lot of things that they do well, but athletics was not one of those, and now it is.
All right, so I don't know, you know, Laura, Noah, if you want to weigh in here, do you feel, I guess his comment is good, you know, the drummer could get hired to be a drummer somewhere, and so now the college athlete or the high school athlete can get some money.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty dramatic shift from the High School Athletic Association, because I think 4 years ago, two-thirds of the schools voted against doing NIL deals. I just think it's a really rapidly changing area, and particularly with this pending lawsuit from the player out of Dayton. And I think Joe is right in that, you know, this can be life-changing money for some of these families, but it's coming at an earlier stage rather than waiting for them to make it to the NFL. Yeah. It's I think it's a matter of fairness to the players, to the student athletes. If they can make money sooner, why wait through a preordained structure that has been in place? This is just changing that.
Right, and I guess you could get hurt any day, right, and then not be able to play anymore. So, right. Yeah, the high school athlete is Jameer Brown, and he is suing, saying he was missing out on over $100,000 in NIL deals. So that's what started all of this.
I imagine this will be a continued conversation at the State House. You know, they just passed a bill. It was turned into a big kind of budget corrections omnibus, but it was originally introduced as controls for the higher education level NIL to say, like, you can't make these college students sign contracts that extend into their professional careers beyond their college athletes. So I imagine, just like, you know, with exploitation of child actors, we're gonna have to see some policies about making sure that people keep the best interests of these student athletes in mind when these deals are happening.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides, and coming up, we're going to talk about some action lawmakers took before the Thanksgiving holiday break, including action related to vicious dog laws. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, we have Laura Bischoff, state politics and government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Ingles, senior reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Noah Blundo, executive editor at Hanna News Service. I wanted to start with some audio from action the Ohio Senate took recently. This is a clip from 10TV, the TV news station here in Columbus. You'll hear a person on the Senate floor, and then you're going to hear the voice of 12-year-old Avery Russell.
Make changes to the laws governing dogs, including dangerous and vicious dogs, and to name this act Avery's Law.
I was just shocked by the entire thing.
With 33 yeas and 0 nays, the bill is passed and entitled.
We passed it unanimously.
So, Laura, Avery Russell's case was highlighted in a multi-newspaper investigation that you headed up for the Columbus Dispatch. Avery was horribly disfigured from a 2024 attack by two pit bulls. And now Avery's Law has passed. So can you remind us of what happened, what led up to this legislation being created?
This project on vicious dog laws had been on my to-do list for 11 years. It dates back to a horrible fatality in Dayton, Clonda Ritchie. She was a 58-year-old woman who was very scared of her neighbor's dogs and had done everything right, called the dog warden, put up security, asked for help, and she was ripped apart and found by a passerby on a snowy February morning. And there were six different lawmakers that tried to change the law, because the current law is very lenient toward dog owners and doesn't give a lot of justice for the victims of these attacks. Typically, somebody might only face a misdemeanor. A jail time is extremely rare. The fines for your dog going out and killing someone or ripping a child's face off are just a couple $100 at most. In Avery's case, you know, the dog owner took it all the way to trial, and I think she got 4 days in jail, and less than $1,000 in fines. So this project had been kind of like, you know, in the back of my mind for a long time, because all these lawmakers tried to change it and it just kind of fizzled. And so we dug into a lot of different cases. We showed how common these dog attacks are and how even devastating ones are more common than you think. They end up in the news in like onesies and twosies, and then they kind of fade away. And they disproportionately affect children. If you talk to the children's hospitals, they deal with hundreds of dog bites on kids every year, each children's hospital in Ohio. So multiply that across all of them, and it's really pretty shocking. So the new dog law will, once the governor signs it and it goes into effect, and the governor has not said for sure he's signing it. I'd be shocked if he did not. But what it'll do is it'll increase the penalties. If you know that your dog is aggressive and has dangerous tendencies, you're obligated to, when you have someone invited to your home, as Avery was on a play date, that you have to put your dogs out of reach of invited guests. That's like a big thing.
Okay. Yeah, so it passed both chambers unanimously, and so now it heads to Governor DeWine. Is it just a matter of waiting to hear from him on it at this point?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when bills pass, particularly shortly before a holiday weekend, it just takes a little while for the clerk to get the bill to the governor, and then the governor gets 10 days to review it and sign it, or veto it, or even do what's called a pocket veto, which is where, and this rarely happens, but you let it go into law without your signature.
So what did you get to talk to Avery Russell or her mom, after this kind of, it went through, you know, both chambers, and it kind of like seemed like it was gaining some traction? What were the thoughts of?
I mean, they're just overjoyed. Mm-hmm. I would say that it's not the law that, Drew Russell would have written, or any of the victims of these attacks. They would have liked to have seen something even stronger. But I would say it's a big improvement over current law. Under current law, Noah's dog can get out of his backyard and go, like, attack and kill someone. And then me, as the lenient dog-loving judge, can say, well, Fluffy didn't really mean it. Noah, you can keep Fluffy. You just have to make sure you abide by these conditions. And then Noah blows off the conditions, and Fluffy gets out and kills somebody else. Only then does the judge have to say, all right, Fluffy has to be put down. I mean, two kills?
Yeah. That was referred to in the debate as the one free bite rule. They said they wanted to kind of get away with
one free bite, one
that.
Free kill.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So that's gone now.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, it will be once the governor
signs. So once the governor signs, have the fines increased? Does the law increase penalties?
Yes.
For people?
Yes. Yes, both.
Yes. And does it give dog wardens any more power? A part of your investigation was that dog wardens in some places don't have any power.
I think it clarifies a lot of the powers of the dog wardens and allows them to seize a dog after an attack rather than allowing the owner to keep the dog in place in the neighborhood where the attack happened.
Okay.
So the current dog law it's really hard to follow. And even a lot of the dog wardens county to county they have different interpretations based on which county. Like over in Licking County, they exercise all police powers under the current dog law, under Ohio Revised Code 955. And they carry guns, they carry tasers, the whole works. But in Franklin County, they do not carry weapons. And if they are going to serve a subpoena or something like that, oftentimes they'll have police agencies with them. Mm. So it varies.
The legislation has a provision that, I think, to Laura's point, to compel the dog warden to report to the appropriate law enforcement authority if they're not the one who does it. Instead of going to the court, they should notify the local police or the Humane Society or whoever, I think, to get at that inconsistency.
In an interview with 10TV, Avery's mom, Drew Russell, talked about the anxiety and the PTSD her daughter still has from the experience.
It's heartbreaking because you just want your kid to be carefree, not worry about what's out there, what's next. Like, you just want them to be a kid.
Now, Laura, you said that you had had this in your back pocket as something you wanted to investigate for 11 years. So that's almost as longer than Avery's been alive. What was it about her case that kind of struck lawmakers whenever they saw your investigation and they were like, we need to do something here?
Well, I mean, it's just so egregious. Here's a kid who just goes on a play date and ends up being taken over to somebody else's house. She was playing outside. She needed to use the restroom. The owner of the dogs had gone out to run an errand and left the kids in the house in the care of her cousin. And, you know, she needed to use the bathroom. And her friend said, oh, here's, let her into the house and said, use the bathroom down the hall. And that's when the dogs attacked. And there was an internal security system that caught the initial attack, which is horrific. And then the body camera footage of the Reynoldsburg police officers' arrival on scene is also horrific. I think that, you know, what's interesting is, like, during the reporting of this, Avery's attack had already happened, but then the Eichelberger case down in Pickaway County in Asheville, in which Joanne Eichelberger was attacked and killed by her neighbor's pit bulls while she was gardening in a little front patio area that was in the condo complex. And one of those dogs had previously attacked and killed a puppy in the condo area, and also attacked that owner. And so it had already been designated as dangerous and had other problems. And the dog warden, you know, didn't respond to multiple times where they could have enforced the dangerous dog laws more thoroughly. And this, you know, this tragedy happened.
Allside's producer Aaron Rabinowitz saw in the Hannah News Service, they have you guys have a notable quotes on around Capitol Hill section. And Republican Senator Nathan Manning talked about the work that you did, Laura, on this series, and talked about Avery Russell's story in particular. And Senator Manning said, I don't always like everything she writes, but she does a fantastic job. So, Laura, how does it feel to know that your investigation and your reporting helped make some change happen?
It's gratifying. I would say that, the investigative journalism relies on people like Avery and the Eichelberger family to share what kind of trauma they've been through, to really put a human face on these issues. And also, I'm gratified that my employer, the Columbus Dispatch, the Cincinnati Inquirer, and my bosses allow me to do investigative journalism, because I think, you shine a light on issues like this, and it can effectuate change.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is the weekly reporter roundtable, and we're talking today with Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Noah Blundo from Hannah News Service. I wanted to move on to, we heard last week that the Ohio Senate might come back this month to finish up some business. So is that still on the calendar? What do we know about what the House and Senate need to do in December, and what sort of unfinished business is out there?
Yeah, so right before the Thanksgiving break, they were passing a flurry of bills. The main focus was on a marijuana and hemp package. They were close to a deal, and then the feds threw a monkey wrench in by basically outlawing a lot of hemp products. But not for a year,
yeah.
In this legislation to end the government shutdown. So the margins were always going to be tighter in the House. And so once the Senate had taken care of it, once the Senate was done with what else they were going to do, they just said, we're going to adjourn. And we're going to see if the House can get its act together. And the House eventually did, late in the evening or early in the morning, whenever it was. So the House came back, voted a package on that, but the Senate had left already. So the Senate will be back on the 9th, I believe. There's a possibility they'll vote on other things. But I also talked to somebody last week who said they might just come in, vote on that, and leave again.
All right. And so, Joe, do you think they'll just vote on that one thing, or are there other bills out there?
Oh, there's other things that they probably could vote on if they wanted to, but who knows? So the thing I'm looking for is to see if there are any gubernatorial vetoes between now and then, and whether we get another fight like we did in the summer over vetoes on anything. I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Yeah. And one other thing, though, I wanted to ask you about, in this flurry of legislation that happened preceding Thanksgiving, there were two budget correction bills, and both of them impact arts and culture funding. Can you catch us up on what happened there?
Yeah, so back in the summer when the legislature passed the state budget, they put in a provision to end what's called percent for art, which is if the state in the capital budget, which is different than the operating budget. The capital budget is like the construction budget where they do school building and sewer and water projects, and also a lot of community projects, parks and theaters and such that the state will contribute toward the renovation or construction of. So the state puts up $4 million or more for a project like that. 1% is supposed to be spent on artwork at that facility, whatever it is. And the legislature wanted to get rid of it. And Governor DeWine vetoed that provision from the budget. And so they came back a few months just last week and
He vetoed getting rid of it.
He used a line item veto to preserve percent for art.
All right.
And so the legislature
it's like a double negative.
Worked with him and came back and said, we will keep percent for art, but no project that percent can never reach more than $200,000, which means once the state's contribution gets to $20 million, the percent for art never gets larger. And he said, his office said in a statement, basically, you know, the governor supports, you know, some support for art in publicly funded buildings. But, you know, we recognize the legislature's concerns about fiscal responsibility. And so this $200,000 cap seems like a reasonable place to land. The Ohio Arts Council told me that if this cap had been in place, only about 16% of prior percent for art projects would have been affected. So it's not, it's really just bigger ticket projects that that this will affect.
So any project that uses state money has this 1%. So if you're building some building or doing something that involves state money, you had to include an art component.
If the state's contribution was more than $4 million. So if the state only gave you $100,000 to help, you know, repave the square in your village or whatever, or reinvigorate it, you would not be compelled to follow percent for art.
Okay.
But if 4 million and up, yeah. And then there was also in the budget, there was the deal to fund the new Browns Stadium with unclaimed funds money. And they set up this continuing unclaimed funds money pot for future stadium or arts and culture projects. And then they came back recently with one of these budget corrections bills and said, well, these can be awarded for sports projects, but not for arts and culture projects.
I was going to say, I had never heard or arts and culture in there anytime talking about this.
It was cultural facilities, which...
Oh. Yeah.
And so I talked to the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Jerry Serino from Lake County, and he said, we didn't want to outsource project selection to the administration, to the Office of Budget and Management. We're not against arts funding. We're still going to do it. But we want to do it the way we've always done it, which is in the capital budget. And we pick the projects rather than letting the administration do it.
All right. So you can't renovate a theater using this anymore. It just has to be sports related.
You can, but the legislature has to earmark it specifically, whereas the stadium funding element of it can be awarded by the governor's administration as it stands now.
Okay. So those are corrections that were made, and
among dozens of other changes. There's always a couple bills to clean up or modify or undo elements of the budget.
All right. Well, this is the Reporter Roundtable, and coming up, we're going to hear more about what lawmakers are working on, despite it being the holiday season. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Juravich. Still with us, Noah Blundo, executive editor with Hannah News Service, Laura Bischoff, state politics and government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles, senior reporter at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. One action I wanted to get to, Laura, in a rare move, the Ohio Supreme Court suspended Geauga County Judge Timothy Grendel for judicial misconduct. And it's a case that actually garnered some national attention. Can you tell us what did Timothy Grendel do to merit a suspension from the Ohio Supreme Court?
Well, first off, I'd like to say it's not that rare for the Ohio Supreme Court to discipline judges. There's a whole bunch of them that have gotten into trouble. Some of them have been kicked off the bench. It can take years for these cases to get all the way through the system. Ultimately, it's the Ohio Supreme Court that decides what kind of punishment. But Tim Grendel, he's had a long history in Ohio politics. His wife was in the House, then they traded, and he was in the House, and then his wife came back, and John Kasich appointed him to the bench in Geauga County as a juvenile court judge back in, I think, 2011. He was brought up on disciplinary issues having to do with him speaking on his wife's COVID bill, and then also speaking at a Tea Party. He did not get disciplined on those two items. The court saw it as a First Amendment right. But he got disciplined on his decision to send two teenage boys, I think they were like maybe 12, 13, 14, 15, somewhere in there, two brothers. They refused to visit their estranged father, and Grendel ordered them to juvenile detention for, I think it was over Memorial Day weekend, they were in for 3 days, and he ordered them held under maximum restrictions. They were not together, and they were only allowed to take calls from their estranged father and not communicate with their mother. You know, if you put a kid in juvenile detention, it can really set their life on a different trajectory. Once you're in detention, there's a higher likelihood that you won't graduate high school, that you can have all these other problems. So detention is really supposed to be an extraordinary measure to protect the kid or protect the public, et cetera. And that was not the case here. It just seemed like it was being punitive because these kids didn't want to visit their dad.
So basically, it was him as a judge siding with the dad and saying that the kids should be visiting the dad.
Yeah, essentially.
Okay. So what?
There were other charges too. Mm-hmm. He's got some sort of feud going on with the county auditor over the payment of bills or something. There were a couple of other cases in the disciplinary record as well. And this went on this case has been going on for like 5-6 years, I think.
The scuttlebutt around
I love that word. All right.
Around Grendel's appointment to the bench several years ago was that Kasich was basically making him somebody else's problem, getting him out of the legislature. Yeah. He had run for a House seat in the middle of his Senate term and then decided not to take it and to continue serving in the House. He was a character.
So what does it mean if he's suspended? Is he's not a judge for a period of time or never again?
He got 18 months of his license being suspended, with 12 months of that suspended or stayed, as long as he doesn't get into more misconduct. It essentially removes him from the bench. He is bumping up against age limits, so his term would have expired, I think, in February 2027, and he would not have been eligible to run again.
Yeah, I believe he's already over you cannot run for judge in Ohio if you will be over the age of 70 when your new term commences, and he is over 70 now, so he would not have been able to seek re-election.
Okay, so he's basically done judging for now. All right. We'll see what happens there. And then, Laura, the Supreme Court also ruled last week that police officers' names may be kept confidential if they are attacked on the job. This is related to public records and also related to a law called Marcy's Law. What was lawmakers' original intent with Marcy's Law? And is this kind of like adding police officers into that, right?
So Marcy's Law was actually adopted by the voters as a constitutional amendment that afforded crime victims with certain rights and certain privacy rights. And then there was like enabling legislation that the you know, they have to like write legislation that kind of matches up with the amendment. So it goes in. And what happened is there's a lot of police departments that started to interpret Marcy's Law when an officer is a crime victim on the job, then that officer is afforded these privacy rights. And my employer, Gannett, USA Today company, thought that that was an improper reading of the law, and they took it to the Ohio Supreme Court, and we lost. So operationally, what's going to happen is if there's a police officer who is shot at, or you know, the car, somebody rams them with a car or something, where they are the victim of assault or a crime, and even if they then go and are involved in an officer-involved shooting and kill the suspect, that officer's name can be held confidential because they get these privacy rights under Marcy's Law. So it is a blow for government transparency, and some would say a win for crime victims' privacy rights.
Okay. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking with Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Noah Blundo from Hannah News Service. I wanted to ask each of you if there's any legislation you're paying the most attention to right now. Because as I said earlier, lawmakers passed a flurry of bills before they left town. We've only been able to hit on a few highlights throughout the course of the roundtable, like last week and then today. But I didn't want to miss anything important. So I wanted to know what you'd be following as it goes through the House and Senate and what the governor has on his desk and things like that. Joe, is there any bill that you are particularly paying attention to see where it ends up?
I am curious as to what the governor will do with the bill that got rid of the four-day grace period for mail-in ballots. He has said in the past that he didn't believe that there needed to be any election reform bill signed, that the election reform that we, or the election process that we have in Ohio is good, that he didn't want to see any more election reform bills. But the federal government has been pushing to make this change. And a lot of states do not have this grace period. And Governor DeWine has basically kind of hinted a little bit that this one, he'll take a look at it because it might be different. So I'm kind of looking to see where he goes with this.
Okay. And that bill passed both chambers and is heading to him. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I believe. Yes.
All right. Noah, what about you? Earlier, you talked briefly about hemp and marijuana. Is there any other bill that you're kind of like waiting to see what happens between now and the end of the year?
I mean, not end of the year, but I'm curious to see what the legislature does on property taxes moving forward. They've done a great deal. Some of those bills still need to be signed by the governor, but I think there's still an appetite for reform there. The property tax system is very, very complicated. A lot of the relief that was passed in the last few weeks has been very general, kind of spread across the board. And I know that there's a lot of people who want things that are more targeted to seniors or to low-income people or something. Mm-hmm. So in addition to just making the property tax system easier to understand and a little smoother operating. So I imagine that we haven't heard the last of that.
Mm. Laura, is there anything that you, you know, are paying attention to as we head toward the end of the year here?
Yeah, the House voted, I think, 77-2 in favor of Andy's Law. It's named after Andy Lansing, who was the corrections officer at Ross Correctional, who was brutally beaten to death on Christmas Day. This is a bill that would give additional time to anybody who assaults a DRC worker, including additional time for throwing bodily fluids on someone. That happens a lot in prisons and jails. It's disgusting. But hardly ever is it prosecuted, mm-hmm. you know, because it's common and, you know, and no physical injury, just super gross. And then also would make murders of DRC employees would be death penalty eligible cases. I think they already are, like in the Andy Lansing case where Sean Cannon is facing the death penalty in Ross County. That case isn't expected to go to trial till late in 2026. But it's interesting because the ACLU of Ohio and the Ohio Justice and Policy Center in Cincinnati, they do a lot of criminal justice work. They are opposed to Andy's law because they think it takes it too far. There's extra penalties that DRC could impose, like taking away the tablets for and educational opportunities for people who are in high security facilities. Mm. Taking away the tablets is going to be hugely unpopular with incarcerated people who really rely on those as their link to the outside world and to their families.
Okay, so you said it passed one chamber. Is that what?
Yeah, so
okay.
It's going to go to the Senate. You know, obviously, I don't think they're going to pick it up. You know,
right now,
next week.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
One other bill I wanted to touch on before we run out of time is Republicans in the House approved a bill that, if passed by the Republican majority Senate, would ban the prescribing of abortion medication via telehealth. Here's Republican Adam Matthews explaining why he thinks this bill is needed.
While telehealth can be beneficial, offering increased access to care and convenience, we've had stories both here and throughout the United States where this falls short with these high-risk medications.
And Jamie Miracle from Abortion Forward had this to say in response.
This legislature is using a completely debunked, quote-unquote, study on mifepristone to attack access to the medication.
Joe, do you know how often abortion medication is prescribed via telehealth? Is this a big issue here in Ohio?
Well, yeah, it's prescribed via telehealth fairly often in mm-hmm. Ohio. I can't remember the number in the abortion report, though it is not the premier way, you know, the mm-hmm. most popular way mm-hmm. of getting that done. You've got to remember there are states around us where abortion is illegal. And, you know, people come from out of state to get abortions. So, you know, there are a lot of factors at play. Also, the federal government has been trying to take some action on this issue of abortion and telehealth. And, you know, the opponents of abortion see this as a way to basically shut down abortions, a lot of abortions for the out-of-state, especially for out-of-state people.
Hmm. I'm not sure why this is an issue right now, but does it go against anything in the Reproductive Rights Amendment that voters approved a few years ago?
Well, if you talk to the people who oppose this bill, they would say it certainly goes against that. They say that this is limiting, that it is a barrier, that all the things that were in that amendment, that it goes against the spirit of it. But one thing we've got to remember is we have a Supreme Court in Ohio that is 6-1 Republican. And a lot of those Supreme Court justices have gone publicly on record saying that they oppose abortion. Mm-hmm. So if this were to pass and if it were to be challenged, it would likely go in front of those justices. And I don't know. It's something that we've got to keep our eye on for sure.
All right. We have less than 3 minutes left. So, Joe, there was one other story that your colleague Sarah Donaldson wrote about that maybe you can talk about quickly. The community energy pilot program. We've been covering energy issues at WOSU a lot, especially with future energy needs. Can you tell me about what's a community energy facility that Sarah reported on?
Oh, man. Let me get that in front of me because I really...
Well, it's been since Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah,
yeah, I know. That's okay.
It's been a while back. But basically, community energy is it's a program of... allows small-scale facilities statewide. They have 1,500 megawatts. That's the max. And they could use renewable facilities like wind and solar and natural gas, those kind of things. the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio would regulate the community energy facilities. Mm. And the legislature could bring, basically raise the, allow that 1,500 megawatt to be raised.
This was a leftover from a big utility reform bill that they did earlier in the year, House Bill 15. This was something that they tried to get included in that and ultimately didn't make it. So people are back for another bite at the apple.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all for your time, and thanks for joining us for the Reporter Roundtable. We've been talking with Noah Blundo, executive editor at Hannah News Service. Thanks, Noah.
Thank you.
And Laura Bischoff, state politics and government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, and go blue.
Oh, man. And then also, senior reporter at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks, Joe Ingles.
Thank you.
Sorry, I got thrown off there. This has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.